Welcome to Strictly Business, Variety's podcast featuring conversations with industry leaders about the business of media and entertainment.
I'm Variety senior writer Matt Donnelly, and this week we welcome Jason Richmond and Kia Kiadian,
co-heads of the media rights group at United Talent Agency. Jason and Kia scour the world for books, long-form journalism, podcasts, and individual life rights to find source material for new movies or your next streaming obsession. Now, books may not seem sexy, but in a world where Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine sells for nearly $1 billion, media rights are at the center of the old and new Hollywood deal economy. Please enjoy our discussion about the supreme power of the Suburban Book Club, how media rights kept the agencies alive during the pandemic, and the future of comics. I think a lot of people generally, and also I would say in Hollywood to some extent, don't know really just how deeply effective and responsible media rights is for populating our content pipeline, and also sort of, the risk of being dramatic, but there's a bit of sort of like kingmaker status in play here, because you are among the people who decide what sort of worlds and stories are coming next. And the market dictates to you, you know, what those are.
I feel like we actually have to dictate, you know, to the market, you know, what the new trends are in a way. And so, you know, it really starts, you know, media rights is a new term that we, you know, branded our group a few years back, because, you know, we used to be known as the book department or book to film, and it just became limiting in terms of the forms of intellectual property that we work with. But you know, we really help guide the lives of authors and journalists and life story rights holders, podcasts, any form of intellectual property that we think could be exploited for film and television adaptation. That's also growing in terms of, you know, the growth that we're seeing in the unscripted world across the documentary space, in terms of us taking, you know, long form narrative articles and turning them into podcasts, and then they turn into hit TV shows. So it's a broader encapsulation of the large amount of intellectual property that we're working with and consuming on a daily basis, and then finding the right home in the entertainment landscape.
Well said. Kia, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that's perfectly said. I mean, I think, you know, we have a lot of partners in our work, and many of those partners are New York publishing agents. Sometimes they're, you know, the podcasts hosts that we represent. And sometimes they're the real life people whose life rights, you know, we're handling. And then on the other side, you know, we have partners that are producers, filmmakers, actors, writers.
Did you guys even begin to estimate how much of film and television people see are actually based on publishing? In terms of fiction, nonfiction.
Well, I think it's harder just on publishing, because I think we did some stat that, like, of the 25 top grossing movies since 2000, like 12 of them were based on underlying material. But you know, I think it varies from year to year. I think also the amount that are driven by comic book properties, and you know, if you look at DC and Marvel and you know, back to, you know, the fairy tale world, in terms of how, you know, Disney is looking to kind of, you know, anoint and control their own IP, even though some of it may not actually be controlled by them necessarily. I mean, I think that we kind of view it as a kind of broader landscape in terms of the intellectual property that we're working with beyond, you know, just debut novelists. We work with a number of states and publications and things of that nature. But I would say, you know, just growth wise, you know, it's super vibrant for what we do. You know, I've been at the company for, I think, 11 and a half years now. And, you know, when I started, we were, you know, 99% in the feature film world. And, you know, the explosion in TV, you know, it really has been, you know, not only the golden age of television, but the golden age of media rights in a lot of ways. It's been really exciting for us to I think really kind of annoying to these new voices are, you know, in the entertainment landscape, in the lit, who are breaking out in the literary world as well. But for us, you know, we're reading and consuming things so early, when their things are selling off of book proposal or early manuscript. And so it's really incumbent on us much of the time to really embrace and highlight those voices and shepherd them into the film and television world anew.
Yeah, my next question is going to be how much more explosive has the, or vibrant, to use your word, has this been since the streamers came in?
It's been a dramatic rise in volume and in terms of the appetite that the streamers have. In addition to the competitive nature of, you know, when you have a bunch of new buyers coming into the landscape, what that does to the traditional buyers and how reactive they are. So I do think that the addition of all these other platforms into the Hollywood ecosystem in general has created, you know, more need for IP. I think you've seen Netflix acquire certain comic book companies and make deals. We, for example, represent a comic book company called Boom, and you know, they have a first look TV deal at Netflix, and we recently sold a comic of theirs called Berserker that they co-created with Keanu Reeves in an auction to Netflix, and pretty much every studio we took that to was bidding on it. So I think that it's created an appetite not only to buy the IP, but also to align with the people that are creating the IP. Many of these companies have hired literary scouts to come in-house and work as their literary coordinators to be able to scout material. And so we've seen, you know, quite an uptick to that, not to mention the uptick that the pandemic has caused, you know, which, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, when everything was shut down, people were at home reading manuscripts, listening to podcasts, voraciously consuming, you know, the intellectual property because they couldn't be out in the field making things. Obviously, now people have kind of returned to production. But there was quite an uptick during the beginning part of the pandemic when everybody was home isolating.
It was just funny because I think as you know, production shut down and people were like, you know, wondering what they were gonna, you know, how they were gonna spend the rest of their you know, work days moving forward. You know, we were just out of our minds, busier than ever, because it was almost as if people learned how to read again and just discovered books as like this, you know, this really, really wonderful new technology. For us, you know, we just embraced it and, you know, hit the ground running, you know, when we were sent home to, you know, restart our work lives, you know, right into the pandemic. So, you know, I think we were really proud of our group, but also, you know, at an agency, we became kind of the hub and kind of the busiest, vertical in a lot of ways.
And now you guys are going to sign that Brothers Grimm account, right? must suck that everything is that all those public domain titles are.
Exactly.
What just came through? I think Gatsby just came through public domain.
Yeah,
and
great.
Now there's like 40 projects, animated movies.
out the gate.
Oh my God. So to your point, I love the idea of people rediscovering the technology of books in the pandemic. But I think in the past, I would say even 6 to 8 months, but really in the past 2 years, you know, as consolidation sort of like just completely grips our entire industry, I think that that's been another sort of spotlight on, puts another spotlight on intellectual property, especially as, you know, investors seem to be moving away from physical assets like superhero studio, a theme park, and investing more in the idea of something a bit more ephemeral, like your media rights savvy. I mean, I think Hello Sunshine is a sort of some people a crazy example of how powerful this space can be. You know, and without asking you to weigh in on the material of the deal, you know, some people are divided. People think that it's either, you know, a $900 million book club or she'll be the next Goop. But when you see something like that come across your desk, does it not just sort of blow your mind that this is the power you can leverage for media rights?
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, I think what that points to really is a return to quality. I think if you look at the productions that Hello Sunshine has been associated with, and, you know, Jason, you should definitely talk about the project that you had with them, Little Fires Everywhere. But, you know, when you think about what that deal signifies, to me, it's really a return to quality, because the output from them has been such high caliber productions, material, you know, all of the elements, whether it's casting, directors, you know, are really A+. And I think in this world where there is so much content, like what helps something elevate to the top? Well, you know, I remember when I was starting out in the industry, I was very skeptical. I thought, you know, oh, it's all about who you know, and that's how things get made, is because, you know, someone's nephew. But, you know, as another agent once told me, the cream will rise. And so we've seen, because of a proliferation of how much material is getting made, the best content is what people want. And if you have a company that's consistently able to identify that, based on underlying intellectual property, they're going to create value. And I think you're going to see a lot of other companies kind of modeling themselves on that model, and really, you know, striving to have, you know, the best taste, or really to fill a specific niche and be the best in a certain niche. So I think you're going to see proliferation of those kinds of companies.
I totally agree. I mean, I also feel that, you know, in my personal experience with them, you know, they do the work, and they have great taste in books, you know, a lot of which are clients of ours as well. But you know, and my experience working with them and putting Little Fires Everywhere together, you know, I had given a galley of the book to Lauren Neustadter, right as she had started working as Reese's new film and TV head. And, you know, she read the book over the weekend, and Monday morning, Reese had an email into Celeste's inbox. So, you know, they both did the work there, and, you know, it showed, and made the decision to go with them, you know, and partnering up to create the wonderful adaptation, that it became so much easier because they really embraced and I think understand authors in a great way, and also understand storytelling. But, you know, their book club, you know, is on fire. If you look at the New York Times bestseller list, it's dominated by the picks that that she's made, and they're just really good books. So, you know, I think it's great. It's been really, really wonderful, to be honest, for the book world and the fiction world in general, and for what we do, because it's really highlighted and broken a lot of new voices. And I think in terms of fiction adaptation, it's provided a lot of opportunity and runway for, you know, discovery of these new voices, and, you know, a lot of just really terrific adaptations across the film and television landscape as well.
To your earlier point, Jason, about some of the more corporate entities and the tech companies hiring literary scouts, that to me has sort of been one of the most interesting things in the past year, how sort of competitive they seem to be internally with each other about sort of who can land that next author. I heard a rumor that Disney Worldwide Publishing is launching an adult label, meaning just a straight down the middle mainstream fiction label, to try to get in on some of that Netflix action. Because you forget, you know, not everything is Little Fires. Isn't Virgin River based on a book series, which is like their runaway summer pandemic hit at Netflix? Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a big best-selling book series. But, you know, I think that there have been a lot of those that have been, you know, discovered, I think, in the film and television landscape that have been, you know, giant titans. You know, previously, you know, we've had just a total bonanza with representing Ellen Hildebrand, who, you know, is, you know, has been writing two number one New York Times bestsellers a year. And, you know, I think people have really rediscovered her throughout the pandemic as well. Her readership has just exploded. And, you know, on top of that, you know, on the film and television side, we've made countless number of deals. They've just been kind of flying off the shelf because I think it's a perfect way to escape and, you know, I think people would love to be off in Nantucket with a drink in their hand and, you know, chowing down on lobster. So, and talking about love and and relationships, you know, and finding love throughout. So, you know, I think the trends kind of ebb and flow, but I think it's been exciting with the focus being on, you know, these authors and their readership and how we can, I don't know. I think the streaming opportunities have provided so much more opportunity than if they had before. I think probably 10 years ago, Virgin River would have been like a 2-hour Lifetime movie. And now you have a big, big hit series on Netflix.
Don't go away. We'll be right back with more from UTA's Jason Richman and Kia Kiadian. We're back discussing the booming business of Hollywood media rights with UTA agents Jason Richman and Kia Kiadian.
It feels like the one, and if I'm missing any, I know you guys will tell me, it feels like the one space maybe that this kind of adaptive work has been faltering is like the big, juicy, awards-baity feature ensemble, eventized, you know, theatrical release. Because I think like some of the recent tries, I know the Goldfinch didn't really work out for Warner Brothers. I think Agatha Christie's doing just fine for a couple of people, but I feel like it's interesting how the one space where it's probably most native to most consumers, it's not really playing there right now, which is, how do you feel about that?
I think it's a matter of format, because I do think sometimes, you know, cramming a big literary adaptation into a 2-hour film maybe doesn't make the most sense. And I do think that, you know, there are times where, you know, maybe we forget that, you know, Greta Gerwig's Little Women was, you know, based on a book as well. And they still can work. And certainly, you know, you have to kind of take a look at what is, you know, you look at what the rebirth of Stephen King and all of the you know, projects that are coming from his books. I do think that, you know, it's a matter of format, and I think people have to be much more attuned to, okay, this would actually work better as a limited series. This would work better as a you know, ongoing series. And having those walls break down a little bit, as Jason was talking about earlier, I think is one of the keys to having success with an adaptation.
Wasn't media rights a bit of a bellwether for you guys in terms of letting people know that the deal market wasn't dead while we were all so uncertain about our futures?
Absolutely. I mean, we feel like, you know, it took us probably a week to get our bearings being at home. But then we kind of hit the ground running and, you know, it felt like it was kind of, you know, bidding more after bidding more. So, you know, we absolutely embraced it and felt like it just hasn't really let up since. In a lot of ways.
And generally really encouraging to see people being willing to invest so much in development, right?
Absolutely. I think that they were taking chances on, you know, wildly cherished novelists to, you know, brand new voices that, you know, have been having a moment. It was really fun for us, you know, someone that I've represented for many, many years who has finally kind of broke out and had a moment this, an author named Charles Yu, whose novel published, you know, it was one of my last trips actually before we were sent home. I was out in New York for a book launch event for Interior Chinatown, which came out at the end of January 2020. He did an event with Celeste Ng, and, you know, the book got some really, really terrific reviews. And then, you know, we started submitting it, you know, right afterward, and it was just people coming out of the woodwork for you know, a novel that I absolutely loved, but was, you know, very inventive in its form and was partially in screenplay and prose and really just kind of played with that. So the adaptation wasn't necessarily just like, it didn't jump out at you, but he's just had such a wonderful moment. And so that's been really great to see, you know, the entertainment entities out in the world really kind of embrace his voice and stature. And we've been able to make some other, you know, really exciting new deals for him, you know, after on the heels of that as well.
Tell me a bit about sort of the non-traditional areas in your department. You were mentioning you guys are increasingly getting into, well, obviously, journalism, but the sort of unscripted podcasts. Can you talk a little bit about how that sort of rounds out your portfolio and how sort of is that something that's being increasingly relied on as well for creative adaptation?
Absolutely. I do want to touch on one thing Jason said, because I do think, you know, something he mentioned in his last response about kind of adapting something. Like it made me think of Nomadland, which was a nonfiction book that our colleague Jasmine Lake was representing. And obviously went on to great success. I think people are also maybe approaching, you know, adapting literary material in a new way, and bringing a twist to it and finding a way to kind of make it fresh. And whether, you know, we look at things like Queen's Gambit or Bridgerton, I think the way literary material is adapted is also evolving. So but moving, you know, forward to something like podcasting, you know, we've represented This American Life and Serial for over 15 years. And, you know, we've seen, because we were at the center of it when, you know, when that boom took off, and with, you know, season one of Serial, or, you know, kind of the emergence of the podcast as underlying material. You know, we've been at the center. The Shrink Next Door, for example, is another podcast that and we have a dedicated podcast group as well. And a lot of the IP that we receive also comes from podcasts that they've gone out and partnered with companies like Wondery on. And so there's immense growth there. And again, there's two businesses there. One is the ancillary business of the film and television that, you know, comes from those podcasts. And the other is the podcast business itself. The same with comic book business. We talked about Boom, you know, Boom Comics. They have a robust ancillary business in both film and television, but also they're the number three comic book publisher behind DC and Marvel. And you know, we're seeing all these other areas that are really having explosive growth, and they're finding ways of growing, whether it's in unscripted or in other categories. It seems that the boundaries that have existed between fiction, nonfiction, TV, film, all of these boundaries are breaking down, and that's certainly to a creator's advantage.
I've been really pleasantly surprised to see how the consumer is engaging with scripted podcasts. I was really unsure about that one. I thought it was sort of like just a flash in the pan, like, you know, talent sitting at home. They need a job in the pandemic, so we'll do like an old school audio series. But they seem to be really working. And I wonder, sort of, do you think that prospective buyers out there are looking to sort of take them to the next level? Do you think that the scripted series would then lend themselves to TV and grow? And I'm just curious what you think the future of that whole space is.
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw it, you know, take off with Gimlet having Homecoming, and, you know that turning into, you know, the successful Amazon series that they had. You know, we have very established authors. You know, we work with Eric Larson, who, you know, storied nonfiction writer, best known for Devil in the White City. He has his first foray into fiction, actually, that's being released next month as an audiobook. Only that's a ghost story called No One Goes Alone that we're out on submission on the film and television front right now, actually, that's creating a lot of excitement. And it's something that, you know, is only going to, you know, live in that space, in the audio space, which, you know, I think is really exciting, for, you know, an author that's only worked in print and only worked in print nonfiction, for this long to be, you know, trying his hand at something new that's definitely shaking things up. And I know publishers are definitely looking to find ways of, basically bridging voices from print into audio. You know, I think there's been such a boom in, you know, in audiobook downloads as well. So there, I think it's created a lot of new opportunity that kind of bridges the gap between, you know, both, you know, the scripted fiction podcast world and also, you know, Audible audiobook, you know, we're listening, we're reading, we're reading while listening, if you will. So.
Absolutely. And, you know, speaking of consolidation, I think a couple of years ago, or my timing might be all messed up because of the Bermuda pandemic triangle. But, you know, when someone like Liz Gabler joined Sony Pictures and I think brokered an exclusive publishing deal with Simon & Schuster, I might be totally wrong after we record this. HarperCollins, yes. And obviously, Elizabeth Gabler has a long track record of successfully adapting books into movies. But I wonder, do you think the publishing houses might become an increasing target for acquisition? Considering just the moment that they're having.
I mean, I think, you know, in speaking also from experience and dealing with 3000, which is Elizabeth Gabler's, you know, outfit partner with Sony and HarperCollins, you know, we made a really great deal for this book by Kevin Wilson called Nothing to See Here that we sold with Neustadter and Weber to Elizabeth. And the deal was really innovative because it, you know, that, it happened to be an Echo book, which was an imprint of HarperCollins. And so, you know, the publisher was able to say, we will actually chip in some ad dollars to promoting the book. And so, yeah. You know, I think that as part of the film deal, I think that, you know, they're also optioning a lot of material that isn't necessarily under the HarperCollins banner, but when it works and you're able to kind of create that sort of synergy, you get the added benefit of it. And you see that with, you know, Viacom and SNS, but, you know, SNS is going away kind of, or we'll see what happens there with that merger. So, you know, I think that we try to just take advantage of the opportunity that is also going to, you know, provide an even greater billboard for our authors, for their literary works as well.
One thing to remember is, you know, the publishing companies don't actually own the film and television rights. And so the publishing company becoming a target for acquisition because it's a source of content, I think, isn't necessarily the right way to look at it. And I think, in fact, you know, one of the things that has become a bit of a controversy are publishers or, you know, newspapers or magazines trying to lay claim to the rights that their authors have. And I think, you know, we saw this big dust up with the New York Times and Paramount happen over the GameStop story. And I think we've seen, you know, many kind of publishers or outlets kind of trying to overreach and take rights that are really created by and should remain with the authors. And so that's something that I think, you know, we certainly are keeping an eye on and wanting to, you know, where we can protect our creators and advise them as these big corporate entities try to lay claim on their ideas and their ability to find the right places to exploit the rights that they, you know, kind of inherently create when they come up with an idea or when they find a story and track down a story and work incredibly hard for years and years to break a story.
There's things you could rip from the headlines almost every single week, especially the past year, that lends itself to cinema or some kind of
but that's also like some of the best parts of our jobs, because you never know when that story that all of a sudden is getting shared all over social media lands in your inbox for representation as well. And so it becomes some of the most exciting parts of our job in that narrative nonfiction space as well. You know, those sorts of timely stories where they involve complicated life rights holders and deals that I think make the best sorts of adaptations for film and television. You know, it becomes an exciting part of our job because, you know, a lot of people ask us, you know, how does every day look? And some of the time you get like a special gift dropped in your inbox at 8 a.m. and that changes the entire kind of direction of your week as well. So we have to be nimble. But you know, yeah. I roll with those fun opportunities.
Is there one you guys are chewing on right now? Like, what's your Zola right now?
For Zola, we're representing this really fun piece on behalf of the Boston Globe about called the Fire Festival of overnight sleepaway camps, about a camp in New Hampshire that was shut down after 6 days for basically all the campers rebelling against the staff and the staff quitting and. You know, it's a wild, fun story that we feel like is a really special kind of contemporary film as well. We're putting together.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. We love to hear from listeners, and be sure to tune in next week for another episode of Strictly Business.